it can be really trivial details like typos or formatting issues that can become anchors that could overshadow a candidate's true potential because the rest of their application will be interpreted against this first impression.
My name is Katharina, and I'm the community and event manager at eCulture, a company that is on a mission to shape the world of unbiased hiring. Welcome to the Oops, I'm Biased podcast. So on today's episode of the Oops, I'm Biased podcast, I am talking to Léonie Grandpierre. She is the head of science here at eCulture, and she's been a frequent guest, a favorite of mine as well. And we are going to cover the anchoring bias today. We are going to talk about what the anchoring bias is, how it relates to recruitment, what moments specifically are most sensitive to anchoring bias, what impact anchoring bias can have negatively, what are bad anchors, what are good anchors, which biases intersect with the anchoring bias, and then how you can minimize the impact of anchoring bias. This is an episode that has been a long time coming. It's a bit of an underrated one, I would say, but nonetheless a very important one. It definitely has a lot of intersections with other biases. We're going to get into that as well, but namely the halo and horns effect, the confirmation bias, the contrast effect. If you've heard all of those on our podcast, then you will love this. And if you haven't, please go check them out after this. But now, without further ado, let me get to the conversation with Léonie. Enjoy. All right. My guest today is a very well-known guest of ours, a listener favorite, one might say, and internally as well. We are going to discuss the anchoring bias. My guest is Léonie Grandpierre. She is the head of science here at eCulture. And I'm very lucky to have her back. This is her fourth episode, actually. So you've done the halo and horns effect, the social desirability one, and the deep dive into cognitive bias. So you've done quite a lot of the legwork for us. There's lots more biases to cover, but today we're going to be talking about the anchoring bias. Welcome, Léonie. Thank you for having me back.
Luckily, there's so many biases out there that I think we have a lot of more episodes to cover in the future.
Yeah, I heard recently Marcia Goddard talked about this, that there's 188 and then there's 175 in another list. So I think there's a few more that we can cover together, which is great. The anchoring bias. Let me start off by saying that I was a bit unaware of that bias just because I think in my mind, well, it sounded quite like a descriptive bias in terms of the name, but then my mind, I think, just didn't really catch on to it just because I thought, oh, that's just another kind of a confirmation bias, let's say. Mm-hmm. But then when I read into it, I was actually thinking, oh, this is quite a relevant one for the recruitment field. But not going to go into depth. You're the expert on it. So can you tell us a little bit about what the anchoring bias actually is?
Yeah, I think the anchoring bias is not always the first one that comes into mind when you talk about biases in recruitment or anything else, really, because there's a lot of overlap with other biases. But what I think it does actually is it provides a sort of setup for other biases to come in. So the anchoring bias itself, it refers to our tendency to use one piece of information, which is often the first piece of information that we learn about something or someone, as a sort of reference point for all of the information that we learn about them, this person or this thing afterwards. So our interpretation of anything that comes after is bound to and interpreted in reference to this anchor, which is usually the first piece of information. And that can have a very big influence on our judgment about things and about our decision-making. So I think a very real life applicable example, which happens to me a lot as well, is if I, for example, go into a store and I see a shirt and on the price tag, I see this shirt used to cost 100 euros, but now it's on sale and it costs 50, then the 100 becomes my anchor. So in comparison to 100, 50 euros seems low. Like it's only half, right? So seeing the 100 primed my brain to categorize this shirt as a sort of like expensive luxury item, So then in comparison to that, my interpretation of it costing 50 euros now is different to what my interpretation would have been if it would have just said 50 on the price tag and nothing else. So yeah, I think this is like, it happens to me all the time. I fully go into that trap and I'm like, ah, this is a bargain. It's half off.
Way too relatable, that example, for sure.
Exactly. But yeah, so for the anchoring buyers, because it happens so much, there's actually a very large amount of research out there that can back up its existence. Because it has been tested in all sorts of variations. And I'd like to discuss two studies specifically that give a bit of an idea of what kind of research can be done to test for biases like these. So my first example is a study in which participants were asked to estimate the outcome of a maths equation. Fun math. But basically, one group was asked to estimate what you would get if you would multiply 8 times 7 times 6 times 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 times 1. And then another group was asked to estimate what you would get if you would multiply 1 times 2 times 3 times 4 times 5 times 6 times 7 times 8. So the exact same numbers multiplied with each other, just presented in opposite orders, starting either with the high or with the low numbers. And the group that had it presented with the high numbers first, they made an average estimate of 2,250 as the outcome. And the group that had it presented with the low numbers first made an average estimate of only 512.
Wow.
Yeah. So both groups were way off. The real answer is 40,320 for anyone who did for some reason not calculate this in their head now. But yeah, obviously nobody was expected to actually be able to calculate this, of course. But it does show that starting with high numbers sets a general expectation of a higher outcome than starting with the low numbers. So when making estimations in general, the first numbers that are encountered have been shown to set the tone for everything that follows. And this is shown in many studies. It's very visible in negotiation settings or when having to estimate the worth of something, for example. And yeah, that leads me to my second example, actually, of a study that I wanted to discuss. This is one of many that shows that an initial piece of information can prime your brain and influence judgments, even if that piece of information has absolutely nothing to do with what you're judging. So in this experiment, researchers asked the participants for the last two digits of their social security number. And then after that, they showed them a couple of items like computer equipment, a bottle of wine, a box of chocolates, things like these. And then they asked them if they would be willing to pay the last two digits of their social security number for each of these items. So if my last two digits would have been 2 and 7, then they would have asked me if I would be willing to pay 27 euros for each of these items. And then regardless of the answer, they would ask what the maximum amount of money is that they would be willing to pay for these items. And they found that the higher the last two digits of someone's social security number were, the more they ended up saying they would be willing to pay for the items. Because with that first question of whether they would be willing to pay the number coming from the social security digits, an anchor was set. And if that anchor was a high number, people were overall willing to pay more when asked about it afterwards, even though they, of course, know that this first number was completely random, since it's just from their social security number and it had nothing to do with the items, it still affected the judgment.
Wow.
Yeah. So it shows a couple of things. It shows that anchors can influence our judgment even if they're completely irrelevant. And it shows that this is an unconscious process because, like, how else would we justify that, knowing that these numbers were random? And yeah, there's way more studies like these that explore all sorts of conditions for different types of anchors and settings. But out of time reasons, I'm going to leave it with these now.
That's great. Those are really interesting examples. I think, well, they obviously not only show what a breadth of situations anchors can sort of influence then our judgment and our decisions. I think, well, we started with how much a t-shirt would cost and then what it is on sale and then negotiations and then, yeah, math equations, who would have thought? I think for me, definitely, when I notice it, is definitely as well with that shopping example of saying, oh, what a bargain, it's 50% off. But I do believe that all of what you said, well, on the one hand, it being unconscious and then also unrelated,
poses some interesting questions about the recruitment process when we do the same and apply it to humans, when we assess them or judge them, whether they would be a potential hire and a potential successful one. Now we're shifting a little bit gears, I would say, and see how that plays into the recruitment process. What do you think, or what do you see more so, is the first moment that the anchoring bias comes into play when we talk about recruitment and hiring?
I think it comes into play earlier than one might think. So earlier than even looking and evaluating your candidates, it can already come into play with job descriptions. So job descriptions, and this is now where the anchoring bias can come into effect for the candidates that are reading the job description, they're often the first thing that a candidate learns about a job. And the information in there can heavily influence how well suited a candidate thinks they are for a job, which in turn influences their application and how they present themselves. So I think it comes into play here in the form of the first qualifications that are listed, for example, in the job descriptions. They can create an anchor for a candidate's self-perception of fit, comparing their skills and experiences to that, and then that might influence whether they apply, and if they do so, with how much confidence they do so. But not just the qualifications, but also the language that's used in job descriptions can be used as an anchor to interpret whether a candidate feels included and therefore sees themselves as a good fit. And then a last thing, also very important, salary indications in job descriptions can turn into anchors for any salary negotiation that follows, which might not be so much about whether someone is a good fit or not in terms of their skills, but it's definitely a big part of the recruitment process. So, yeah.
I think the first two examples for me that came to mind was one, salary indications for sure, because that's definitely an anchor that I think is just so hard hitting. And then the other one for me, at least how I read job descriptions, was years of experience. So when they said 2 to 5 years of experience and I didn't have that, instantly low confidence, even if I applied, because I was thinking, well, can never even get to close to the five. I'm 5 years away from that, you know?
Absolutely. Also, just depending on how close you are to that number that is stated. And I mean, we all know sometimes these years of experience that are listed are extremely arbitrary. So I think this is a good one for recruiters to take into account. Really think about the numbers that you're using there as years of experience, because not just should it actually be meaningful, as in you should, any extra year that you add should actually be justifiable, but it's really going to make a huge impact on how people are going to see themselves when they read this description and how they're then going to come across in their application as well.
Yeah. A question that just came up for me, because we were talking about, well, anchoring bias is obviously also to do with time sensitivity, right? Sort of chronology of when information is shared. Does that also heavily influence how you structure a job description? Sort of what information comes first? Because you were saying about skills and qualifications.
I think in terms of skills and qualifications, I would definitely think about the order in which you list them, so that the first thing that you list should also be the most relevant one, as in it should either be the most important one that's a make or break for you, or one that is, in your opinion, which is hopefully backed up, the one that's most predictive of whether someone is going to do a good job or not. Because if you put something that's less relevant right in front, then that is still likely to become someone's anchor.
Yeah.
And that is then going to influence the way everything else is interpreted by the candidate.
Yeah. So, I mean, that probably goes into a whole different bias that we think that lists are listed in terms of importance, right? Sort of that the order has something to say about the importance or the logic of things. So that's definitely good to note. Now, you mentioned that there's a couple other moments. You mentioned candidate screening already. How do you see the anchoring bias coming into play with candidate screening?
Yeah, I think during the candidate screening process, there's a lot where the anchoring bias can influence the way that other information is interpreted. So it kicks in when we encounter the first candidate. So let's say we look at an assessment result or a CV or whatever the piece of information is that you get about a candidate, the first candidate can become the anchor against which all the others are compared. So again, it's a question of order here. So depending on how well they fit the role, the suitability of others will be compared to that. If you start out with someone who is an amazing fit, then the next person who otherwise you might have also seen as a good fit, who is just slightly less good of a fit, is immediately going to be interpreted as less good than if they would have come first, maybe. Similarly, the initial information that grabs our attention about an individual candidate, like a prestigious university, a well-known company that they worked for before, that can set an anchor that affects our perception of the applicant's qualification and how we read everything after. This is where confirmation bias kicks in as well. We've mentioned this before. We can get back to that later as well. But yeah, it doesn't really stop there. So it's not just the pieces of information that you put on your CV. For example, let's say you're doing your screening with CVs. It can be really trivial details like typos or formatting issues that can become anchors that could overshadow a candidate's true potential because the rest of their application will be interpreted against this first impression of maybe not being detail oriented because there was a typo that primed our brains with associations like that. Mm-hmm. So I think, in candidate screening, the potential of anchoring bias is limitless.
Yeah, I was going to say that sounds like an endless list.
Yeah.
Do you think that particularly in that stage, is there a bit of a conscious process that goes on for recruiters, let's say, who are screening CVs?
I think it's definitely one where awareness can help already. I think there's some biases where awareness doesn't do that much, but with anchoring bias, if you are aware how much that first piece of information can influence all of your judgment after, I do think as long as you're aware and as long as you're taking a moment for yourself to think about this and think about what was the first thing I learned about this person and might that have shaped my influence, my judgment of them afterwards, I think that could definitely help.
Conversely, would that also mean that people, if we say now someone's very meticulous with their grammar and spelling, if there is a typo and that is a deal breaker, is that sort of a conscious awareness of anchoring bias for that recruiter? Or would you say that that's a different mechanism?
Well, I guess that that would depend a bit on how important that is to you. So let's say you're hiring for a role where being extremely meticulous is very, very important and you need someone who is extremely detail-oriented and does not make any tiny mistakes, then that could actually be a very conscious thing that mm-hmm. you're looking for. And that could be a very conscious reason to maybe exclude someone.
Yeah.
However, I would say for most roles, that should not be a make or break criteria.
No, for sure. Yeah, no, I think we always, in these episodes, we always ask each other, so to a certain extent, is it conscious, is it unconscious? Mm-hmm. And then also in the second step, as you say, is becoming aware of the bias, or you're already halfway there if you're just aware.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess for some, you just need to do a lot more than just being aware.
Definitely.
I think one last one that I would love to touch on in terms of moments that are affected by anchoring bias is interviews.
Yeah. For job interviews, there's a similar effect as with the first screening, where the first one interviewed can become sort of an anchor for those interviewed afterwards. This is something that's quite visible also in the evaluation of interview answers. So if the first candidate performs well, let's say, and receives a high rating, then that sets a very strong anchor. So subsequent candidates may be rated comparatively lower, even if their performance is objectively similar or even better, but the initial rating served as a reference point that then biases our evaluations in that case. That is a very, very tough one to overcome with anything else than just trying to be aware, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, because you're sort of moving the goalpost or the mm-hmm. benchmark that you set in the beginning.
Yeah, just be aware of the fact that you might be judging someone differently who came after someone who you had a strong opinion about, or think about who might have been setting your anchors.
Yeah. Oh, that's such a common one. I can even feel it come up for me as well. Like, I think that's such a relatable one where you just get sort of the the person gives the perfect answer, whatever mm-hmm. that is for you specifically, and then someone else comes and you're just a bit less impressed.
Yeah, and their answer might have been absolutely fine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, which is horrible. But I mm-hmm. think in that way, yes, awareness is important. And then yeah. also probably we're going to talk about that later, how you can limit that. Mm-hmm. The impact, which I'm not going to give away now because I think you have a lot to say on that as well. Yeah, I think to wrap it up, there's a lot of moments, right, in the recruitment process where anchoring bias hits hard, and then some where it hits a bit less hard. But mm-hmm. job descriptions, candidate screening, and then interviews are just really, really important to look out for. Now, getting into the impact that anchoring bias can have on the recruitment process, what do you think sort of negative impacts that it has?
I think the impacts are pretty widespread. It can impact a lot of things that maybe we're not even that aware of, but the very obvious one to me that comes to mind is possibly a lack of diversity in the people that you hire, because if you use existing norms in your company as anchors on what to judge people against, then that just leads to hiring a lot of similar people, which could even be using the person who had the job before that you're filling as an anchor mm-hmm. of what kind of performance you expect. And that, okay, that would even be not too horrible if it's just about performance. But I think what happens a lot is that characteristics or personality traits that have nothing to do with performance in the end
yeah.
are still used as anchors based
on... Or even if they come from the same place.
Even if they come from the same place, if they came from the same university, if they have had a similar background, that doesn't mean that people who don't have these wouldn't be doing a good job, but they then compare differently to this anchor who is maybe the person who had that job initially. So that is definitely a negative impact of anchoring bias, lack of diversity. I think generally, and this is not just anchoring bias, but any bias in recruitment, bias decision making always increases the probability of making a bad hire. Making bad hiring decisions, so that people might not actually be a good fit for the job that they're hired for, or fit into the culture very well. And that obviously can easily lead to like a lack of job satisfaction by the candidates or by the team, because they're now working with someone who is maybe not performing as well. And yeah, eventually that could also just lead to higher turnover rates, which is exactly what you're trying to avoid. But this is not something that's specific to anchoring bias, though. I think this is any bias decision making in hiring that yeah. can lead to that.
Yeah, I guess. And we're going to talk about that as well in a moment. Biases in any way, they play together, right? They have impact on each other, and that has long-term effects mm-hmm. of how that then influences, well, yeah, retention and diversity, as you say. I think that those are important points. Let's give our audience a few examples of what are some really bad anchors.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of bad anchors, I think obviously anything that's not predictive of someone's ability to do the job or fit within the team or the culture. So any kind of criteria that has nothing to do with how someone is going to perform, like you need 7 years of experience, for example, if that's not actually necessary.
For a junior role, no.
For
less.
Junior roles, exactly. Yeah, the horror. or also, I mean, these are even ones that maybe in some universe you could find some backup for, but there are some things in job descriptions about people having to have done, having to have studied abroad, having to have done, a board year in their student association, things that really have zero proven value to predict someone's performance. These are going to be horrible anchors in your process. And then, of course, anything that evokes stereotypes, which can start at names, even though I understand that's a very difficult one to avoid, but also things like pictures up front, seeing a name or a picture as the first piece of information. Again, here we are talking about the order. What is going to evoke any possible stereotypes that you might have? And you can tell yourself that you don't have stereotypes, but I'm very sorry to tell you, you do. I do as well, and Kat does as well, and there's not much we can do about it. So let's try to avoid to have information up front about candidates that could evoke them. And then when using assessments, which I'm generally all for, then you still need to be careful, because bad anchors could also be unrealistic expectations of the results of these assessments. So, for example, if you have a skills assessment or a cognitive assessment, and you only expect above average performance, this is something that I hear a lot from people. People always want above average performers on everything. But not everyone can be above average. And also not every job out there requires above average performance. I'm sorry. Your job is not the most complicated thing in the world, probably.
Ouch. I think that'll hurt some of our listeners. But yeah.
I'm so sorry to say, but some jobs will do absolutely fine with people who have average cognitive abilities and skills.
Yeah.
So I think there it's just important to not set arbitrary cutoffs. Like, I just want above average, or I just want at least 80 out of 100 or whatever your scale is. So don't set arbitrary cutoffs that you don't have an actual justification for, because that will generate bad anchors for interpreting your results.
Yeah. I think I heard you say that a couple months back. It was really a light bulb moment for me, where you said, well, if everyone was above average, then the above average would be the average, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So in a way, if everyone requires a very high level or a high score on whatever assessment you have, mm-hmm. then again, we're in the average, right?
Yeah,
so,
exactly. It's all relative in the end.
And then maybe also reframing, what does average actually mean?
Exactly. Average is not a bad thing.
No, average is really good.
The average person tends to do a pretty good job if they're in the right fit, in the right role.
Yeah. Oh, that's really good advice on that one already. Now, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about some good anchors, because mm-hmm. I think that's equally important now that we talk about bad anchors. What's a good anchor? What should you anchor your ship on?
Okay. So definitely think about meaningful requirements. So what do you actually need? If you're going to have a degree requirement, only do that if that degree is actually giving someone job knowledge that they need. So I'm not saying don't ever ask for degrees. If you're hiring someone who requires knowledge of the law, then maybe they need a law degree. That's all fine. But just make sure that this is only the case when that actually will predict how they will perform, because they need the certain type of knowledge. If you have an assessment, then make sure the assessment is assessing relevant competencies. And I would say determine what scores you require on this assessment, based on the job demands, and if possible, based on something like a top performer analysis in your company, if you have enough people, and if you have an objective way of assessing performance to select those top performers. But if you have something like that in place, that could actually be a very, very good anchor, because then you can set up your process in a way that this is the first information that you receive about someone. So that first piece of information that's going to form your anchor, which you will have an anchor, right? So at least make it something that's relevant. Make it something that actually has something to do with what you're looking for. There's also a study actually on this that shows that having accurate predictive anchors in place in the hiring process creates more accurate estimations by hiring managers. This is research backed. I'm not just making this up. And in general, I would just have a look at the order in which you receive information about your candidates. Try to organize your screening in a way that the first piece of information you get is actually the most predictive of their abilities.
Yeah, I think that's super important, especially, well, if we're talking about time sensitivity, if you have an anchor that is actually predicts potential, sort of you have sort of the hard facts, then that'll then anchor you through the whole process, right? Because mm-hmm. then you can get into the interview where there could be a lot of anchors that, again, sort of influence how you see someone. If you already have that anchor that is a good one, then you can hold on to that.
Yeah,
much easier.
And that's actually at least one where we have some data. Maybe we can link the reference of the study in the episode description, but there is actually some research that looked into this, creating more accurate estimations of someone's potential. So
I think that's reassuring to hear. We'll definitely link all of the studies that you spoke about in the show notes, for anyone who's interested to go a little deeper, to also see what exactly that research and methodology looked like. Now, I think this last question is sort of I need to ask, but we already spoke at length, I think, right now about it, is how can you minimize the impact of anchoring bias? I think now we've spoke about having a good anchor is already one, but what else can you share?
Yeah, so as we said, try to set it up that you get the right information at the right time, then hire based on competencies. So actually think about what does someone need to know or be able to do, instead of just using what has always been used to look for someone's potential. Something else that's always important is have a diverse interview panel, have people who come from different backgrounds, who think differently on this panel. That always minimize the risk of bias, because you're going to have a bunch of people who are going to have different biases. So overall, there is more potential for there to be slightly clashing opinions, which leads you to have to explain and justify your opinions, which leads you to actually think about things a bit more than just going off some gut feeling. There's something that I heard that I think is a very brilliant idea, is appointing a devil's advocate in the process. So having someone involved in your hiring process whose entire job or responsibility in the process is to be against the popular opinion and try to find evidence against the decisions that are being made. There is a study that looked into this, into a strategy called considered opposite strategy to tackle anchoring bias specifically in recruitment. And it's a very similar concept to appointing a devil's advocate in your process, actually. It means make it a point, make it someone's responsibility to challenge any decision and assumption on who's the best fit for the role. And it may surprise you to see that it's often not that hard to actually find things in someone's application that would confirm the opposite of your evaluation of them. It's an interesting way to challenge your own biases and evaluate a bit where your assumptions are coming from and based on what standards or anchors you're interpreting someone's qualifications. I encourage everyone who's hiring to try this out at some point and just try to find evidence for the opposite of your assumption or the opposite of your gut feeling, because it can be scarily easy sometimes to actually find something to back up the exact opposite of what you were thinking.
Yeah, that's great advice, however hard that might be to sort of overcome that initial reluctance. But I think that's really good advice, and appointing a devil's advocate, I think, can help in that a lot, to have a dedicated person in the room whose only job is to
criticize.
Find the flaws and criticize. Maybe some of our listeners thought, oh, this could be me. I really enjoy challenging people.
Exactly. It might be a very fun job, actually, in the process.
Yeah. I surely would enjoy that selfishly. Now, before I let you go, I quickly want to touch on the biases that intersect with anchoring bias. I know some of them we've already covered on the podcast, so be sure to go back. If you hear one that is interesting, type it in the search bar and find it. Otherwise, we're going to cover it soon. But which ones do you think intersect the most?
I think this we already touched upon, but there's a really strong relationship with confirmation bias. So maybe just as a recap, this is the bias where you tend to pay more attention to information that confirms some view that you already hold, and you have a tendency to ignore or dismiss information that doesn't fit with this view that you already have. I think we have a podcast episode about the confirmation bias already.
Yes, we do. One of our first ones.
Yeah. And then I think another one is the halo and horns effects. That's actually one of my episodes as well.
You can do some selfish,
some selfish marketing here.
Exactly.
But that's basically where with the halo effect, something very positive about someone is going to kind of overshadow more negative things about them, and you're going to interpret them as a whole as positive just because of one very positive thing, or in the other way around with the horns effect. If there's something very negative about them, you're going to interpret everything else about them in a more negative light as well. Mm-hmm. And then stereotyping, I already mentioned. I think that doesn't require that much of an explanation. I think there's also, I'm just advertising for other episodes here, but I do think we have that one covered as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think these are probably the ones that have the strongest relationship with anchoring bias. But in the end, most biases have a tendency to play into each other a little bit.
Yeah. I was also thinking maybe the contrast effect. I'm not sure mm-hmm. how.
Yeah,
how
definitely. True that is. I think that one, the contrast effect is also one where the order comes into that we discussed before, comes into play a lot. So who do you talk to first? Whose information do you get first? And then how do you contrast other people against them?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Leonie. This was a wonderful conversation.
Thanks for having me back again.
This was, well, a much needed one. I don't know why it took us so long to talk about the anchoring bias. It's definitely an important one. Thank you for sharing all of your studies with us, all of the expertise that you have. I think we're all going to come away from this much wiser, much more aware, hopefully. And we would love to have you back in the future if you accept our invitation.
God, are you going to tell them that we already have another episode planned?
There is one already in the works, which I'm very excited about. I'm not going to say which one it is just yet.
Let's keep it a surprise.
Exactly. And for everyone who's listening, thank you so much for listening in. And I hope to see you back on the next one. Bye.
Bye.